when I watch it, especially because, as you saw, we lost George Esser and Ben Ruffin this year, which George was sort of more expected because he was in his 80s, but Ben was sort of out of nowhere. In fact, I think he had a heart attack after jogging or something. So some awful stuff. I want to say that obviously a film can't do what a book can do in terms of details and stuff. And as you can probably imagine, the story itself is so massive that we had to make a lot of very, very, very difficult decisions about what to include, what not to include, in terms of what's the best way we can get what we felt were some of the most important points across to people without confusing them, without overwhelming them. You know, it's funny because we've discussed today about the acronyms, how the War on Poverty is like acronym happy, and that, we ran into that with this, and my editor was just like, we have to cut down on the acronyms, everyone's going to be so confused. So that's why we left a lot of those sort of out and things like that. Anyway, open for questions, comments. Oh, did you want to say something?
I am. I'm gonna. I will moderate, but I do. I am gonna exercise my prerogative here to make some comments, since I should contextualize things. There were about 90 seconds in this film that overlapped directly with my own work on Rocky Mount, with that whole Tarrytown fire incident. But actually, in addition to being familiar with the North Carolina Fund because I deal with it in my book project, I'm also familiar with the North Carolina Fund because so long ago that it was even before I started graduate school was the first I got to know about the North Carolina Fund, because I started doing some research for Jim Lalutis and Bob Korstad, who are working on a major book study on the North Carolina Fund. So look for that in the future. But it's, I have to say, as someone who's been immersed in the fund for a long time, that it was so exciting for me to see this film. And and I might have a quibble here or there, and you'll forgive me that.
Oh, but, please, yes.
But overall, I just think it's an incredible achievement that you actually did manage to capture so much of what the fund was about, and so much of how the fund really managed to kind of walk the talk in ways that are truly remarkable in that time period, in terms of integration and their commitment to having an integrated staff and to sending out integrated teams, or trying to send out integrated teams of organizers, and sometimes having to pull away from that. Certainly by standing by Howard Fuller, and making a decision that that they would say, yes, we're going to support political organizing, and I think that the film captures well the kind of development or evolution that took place in the fund over the years, in terms of, well, what does it mean to address poverty in these communities? What does that take? And moving from sort of service provision to self-help to organizing, not necessarily in that linear a trajectory, or maybe adding on the pieces as you went.
Well, like someone mentioned earlier, it's very fluid. You know, it's a very fluid...
Yeah, it absolutely is.
They didn't even know, I think, what they were getting into. I mean, that's, and I did a lot of interviews, and of course we couldn't get everything, but that's one of the things that they say, even, like, we didn't really know what we were getting into. And, you know, when things did get to the point where they had to have that meeting, you know, they didn't expect to be having that confrontation versus consensus meeting. They thought that they would be able to do their thing and everything would be great.
Yeah, well, and that's one thing that I'm really glad that the film talks about, that sort of, you know, the fact that they did really have to say, well, what are we going to do? I mean, Howard Fuller is giving this, you know, inflammatory speech. It's interesting to hear him today reflecting on it. I'm like, I mean, he's reading back on it, but I mean, there's a lot of passion there, which, even if he wasn't saying go beat people up with baseball bats, he was making a point about, you know, he was making a point about what's of about what was going on, and I think a valid point. But I'm glad that that piece is there, because I think it gestures towards something that, you know, maybe I wish in the hour and a half version could be a little bit more part of it, which is just the fact that there were internal tensions within the fund about what should we be doing. And, you know, one of the details that gets lost is that, you know, Fuller's promotion is you get to have your own sub-agency, the Foundation for Community Development, and that's where we're going to house the organizing, and that's going to insulate some of the other projects from the kinds of the attacks that you also see.
Along those lines, I just want to say that we are going to launch like a blog which has more information about these things, and very much we see this film being used in conjunction with Bob and Jim's book, which is going to give more details and things like this. Like you said, I wish that we, you know, originally it was longer, you know, but if you want to get, you know, if you hope for a broadcast, exactly, it has to be in that 56-40 range, and which is very upsetting for a filmmaker to cut things. I could have had, in the original cut, we had a whole sub-story about Ann Atwater and her character arc, and which is still going on the deleted scenes, by the way, of the DVD, you know, in terms of how she started off as very much, again, like we were talking about earlier, she was not politically active in any way before this. She was worried about making enough money so she can support her children, and she had two really icky husbands who did not support her in any way, and she was just trying to live her life. And then Howard Fuller came knocking on her door, and it's exactly what she said. You know, her eyes came open, and she never closed them again, and she became one of, and she still is to this day. This woman could do more from a phone, from a hospital bed with her phone, than like the majority of us could do in a year, like fully functional. She's just a tireless advocate for everyone that needs help. I wish I could sort of go into that. And like I said, I mean, we had this whole character arc with her starting off as not doing anything. And she tells this amazing story. I don't know if you saw with some of the posters where it was talking about Greenberg. He was an absentee landlord who was one of the main people they were sort of fighting against. And she went she took a bunch of folks and went to his house. And his, gardener, who was an African-American, turned the hose on her and soaked her down. And so originally we had this whole character arc of here was this woman who started off, you know, not doing anything, and she was pushed down by getting soaked. And then later she becomes the person that knows more about housing and more about, you know, all these other issues than like the experts do. She snuck in and like stole like the a manual that explained all like the statutes and stuff, and they made photocopies of it, you know. And I mean, and she knew how to inspect a house, how many, you know. She, you know, amazing, amazing stuff. From nothing to here is this woman that was able to do anything. I wish we could have had, you know, more of that in it, but, you know, we were commissioned to really do a film about the fund. You know, to me, it's more interesting, you know, a lot of what the grassroots folks are doing. So we definitely tried to keep that in it, but it really, we had to sort of pull back and tell more of a story about the fund itself and the shift of the fund.
And it's interesting when you say that, because when I saw it the first time the other night, I was thinking about the extent to which it tells the story of the fund. And then I caught myself saying, well, I mean, what is the fund without the programs and the communities? And there is that kind of tension in the film where, you know, those local stories and the people who populate them and who move those stories are a part of the fun story. And so I think you have actually managed to make that work. And I was sort of smiling to myself as you were talking about Ann Atwater, because the next kind of point that I wanted to make, which is something that I was thinking about earlier today, about, you know, how we think about the consequences of the war on poverty, and that's actually how participating in war on poverty projects affected the people who were part of them. And one thing that I think really does get captured nicely here is how fund staff was affected by it, how the college volunteers, you know, there's that wonderful sort of, you know, the college student optimism about, oh, I'm going to go out and change the world this summer in 10 weeks.
Right.
And the sort of eye-opening experience that they had and the reflections on that. But, you know, but most of all, the people who were organized in these communities and what that meant for them. And, you know, my book is going to talk a lot about the kind of roots of political disengagement in economic oppression and violence and other things that that account for Ann Atwater at the start of the story. And I think it's great to sort of see that progression the way the film does it. I also know that I think you did a really good job, particularly of bringing in Newark and Watts and providing that national context of the civil rights movement that we've been talking about today. Something that struck me as even ironic, given your past work, is the absence of more discussion of the civil rights movement in North Carolina and in the communities.
It was in the original cut. We had a whole thing about. It's actually now in the Durham film that my boss is working on, that we're actually screening next week, which is the whole history of Durham, 150 years of Durham history. Wow. But we did have that. Which was this whole idea, especially in Durham, how you had voluntary desegregation in 1963, and that it was very peaceful, in fact, and that, and we talk about in the Durham piece, but then how just a couple of years later, when you get this more confrontational model, that Wentz Grabarek, who's the mayor of Durham, turns his back on, you know, the activists at that point, because he's like the slow and steady wins the race guy, and working together and all this, but, you know, once they were like, this isn't going the way we wanted, and we're gonna crash the city council meetings and stuff, he turned his back on them, and Ben Ruffin, in fact, says he became an adversary, and that is the case. So we did have a lot more of that, including Eyewitness to History did an actual special. I was telling you earlier that compared what went on in Durham to what went on in, I believe it was Kentucky or Mississippi, and the difference between this sort of desegregation and how in Durham, you know, it was very, you had meetings with different groups of folks, and they were able to really do it in a peaceful, voluntary way, as opposed to a lot of things that were going on in other places. But the thing is, I also think that that's sort of besides the point, because, what's now? Like Jim Aluda says, and I'm sorry about the audio mix too. That's one of the things we have to work on. I think the score was a little loud, but Jim Aluda specifically says that although there had been a lot of progress in civil rights movements, especially in Durham specifically, that there was much, much that still needed to be done in terms of economic equality and educational equality and various things like that. But like, I mean, to put in all this stuff, it's like added time.
yeah,
and unfortunately.
And we get that when editors say your book is too long.
Right. So.
It's not just your venue. I see hands going up, so I will cut myself off, though I have endless things to say about this. But Tom, and then Mark, and whoever else wants to jump into the fray.
Thank you.
Okay, good. I told you I consulted on the Black Side Incorporated War on Poverty series. Everybody should see that too. And they've got a formula, right, that we talked about, which is basically establishing, learning, meeting reaction, crescendo of confrontation, and then denouement of legacy, right? And I think you've got a similar structure here. But I'm not quite sure. There are several confrontations toward the end of the film upon which that structure could turn. And I'm wondering, I don't know how fixed in stone this is, but I'm wondering if it's possible to stick with that housing issue and the city council, and because that, to me, felt like the confrontation, not necessarily the threat to Howard Froehlich's job. I mean, just filmically, that felt like the moment of confrontation. So if there is resolution or denouement or legacy coming out of that, I wonder if you know about that or could include some of that in the film. Because what we get in terms of legacy is indeed the enduring CDCs and nonprofits throughout the state. and I'm not quite sure that has the kind of visceral sense that mm-hmm. you know, when the dramatic structure turns on confrontation.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, what happened after that meeting? Is there something we can learn about?
The reason I'm smiling is because there was actually much more about the Durham housing issue in it. And the end actually was completely different. And it really dealt with what was going on today and all this. And unfortunately, we sort of got the ixnay from people that we are answerable to some degree in terms of funders and various things like this, in terms of shifting the focus back to the fund itself.
So was one of your titles, Change Comes with a Baseball Bat?
Yes, no, You're Destroying the Southern Way of Life was one of them. But I agree with you. I think that the housing issue is the most fascinating. And in fact, I actually have archival, and I don't know where it went. I'm like, where is it? Originally, it was actually a longer story, too. And Ben Ruffin talks about standing out in front of the city council, and these people threw a bottle at him, and really things started to almost go crazy. And in fact, unbelievably, I have archival audio of that moment, because there was reporters out there, and they were taping, and all of a sudden they're just like, you have a whole, you know, a giant group of activists are outside the city council, and all of a sudden just chaos erupts. And, I mean, it's on live radio, and we're going to put that in that section. So I think that that's also going to, you know, sort of add to that. There's still problems with housing.
Did they win something that you could tell us about at that point?
What?
Did they win something that you could tell us about?
No, in fact, it was just more and more a struggle. They're still struggling with the housing issue today, unfortunately. Another great story that we had in there was the story of Joyce Thorpe, who lived in public housing, single mom, and one of the first things that they tried to do was organize daycare for the kids, and they started, and Howard, this is so great, I'm so upset it had to come out, but Howard Fuller says we called it the Mother's Club, because who was going to mess with mothers, he says, and he goes, the Durham Housing Authority, because as soon as they found out that she was the head of the Mother's Club, they evicted her, and she sued them, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and she won. And in 1969, and because of Thorpe versus the Durham Housing Authority, people cannot be kicked out of public housing without, some sort of a hearing or something like that. So yes, I mean, there's so much that was in there. We had to unfortunately pull that out, and that didn't happen until 1969. You know, when that so that was like a 5-year period where she didn't pay rent, she just kept putting it in the bank, you know, waiting, and sort of stay there. So there's 800 million interesting stories, but I agree, it does sort of leave you a little...
Christina's book.
Christina Green's book, Our Separate Ways, deals with Joyce Thorpe. And there's also a new volume that's going to be coming out, edited by Kuzmer and Trotter, Ken Kuzmer and Joe Trotter, that's going to have a series of essays in it. And in mine, I deal with public housing on the national context and try to begin to link some of the different states and cities together in terms of activism on the ground. And I talk about Joyce Thorpe and go into some of the legal ramifications and discussions around that case, too. So, but that's that specific case, yeah.
Great.
I know that Mark had a question. I do want to, however, at risk of delaying Mark, I did want to pick up on this question of how the film ends, because I was thinking about that as well, and I don't know if this would fly, but or if there's time to do it. But one thing that I was thinking about is that, and I gestured toward this before, that you know I think that one of the thematic threads that comes through is actually how the fund affected the people in it. And I wondered if, I mean, I lived in North Carolina long enough to appreciate the point that you're making there, and I also have a sensitivity to why you might have some pressure to make that point, and that's fine, but I wonder if you couldn't follow up on that by, I don't know what the name of the woman who spoke at the end who said exactly what I would want to say at the end is, but I was curious to know, what did she do after she worked with WAMI? and, you know, talk about what Ann Atwater did afterwards, because it's not just that these people went on to staff community development corporations, it's that they continue to be politically active in other ways. And I think that's the legacy story that you can tell and still have it be the legacy of the fund in a way that's
maybe more
palatable.
Absolutely. We're going to rewrite that VO. That is part of what we are going to rewrite to make that point clearer, because, you know, the amazing thing is almost all of the volunteers that I spoke to who had been volunteers, this is what they've done with their life. They've worked in anti-poverty work, economic development work. I mean, and that's what she does. I mean, she works in she lives in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. She works with, you know, inner city kids. She's really involved with education. Amazing. Another guy who unfortunately didn't make it in the film, Alan Fairbank, he works in international economic development. He travels all over the world. That's what he does. And really, it is something that stayed with these folks and affected them so deeply that this is what they ended up, you know, doing with their lives and continue to do. And I do want to get that point across more. And another point that that two people bring up, I believe Nathan Garrett does and George Esser in the interviews, and I'm thinking about trying to work that in, is this other sort of consequence, which was it did open up a lot of jobs to African Americans that those opportunities weren't there before, in terms of in public policy areas, in local government, you know, various things like that. Ms. Newsom, Dimple Newsom, who I interviewed in Ahoskie, North Carolina, she you know, basically she was just like so pissed off about the African American leaders and people in the government around her area that she felt were totally failing her now. Because she's like, now all we do is vote for color. That's what she told me. Mm-hmm. It's not about what the person's about. And she just went on and on about it. But both Nathan Garrett and George were saying that, you know, in terms of these community development corporations and things like this, that you had a lot of opportunity for African Americans to come into the workforce in those areas that weren't there before.
Question sort of follows up on that. First off, I like that in the film the radicals come from Milwaukee, Chicago, and Haight-Ashbury. Since I study Milwaukee, that sort of, you know, makes me feel good. But the character arc question I have is about Howard Fuller. I know a Dr. Howard Fuller, who was the superintendent of schools
in
Milwaukee for
Same
quite
guy.
A long time. And he had worked primarily, or he was seen to be primarily, a proponent of school choice. And
correct.
Charter. And my mother runs a charter school in Milwaukee and knows Howard Fuller pretty well. And to see him sort of documented as this black power activist and then have that run against the counter narrative where the National Education Association, the Wisconsin Education Association were basically fighting him for, I think, 15 years before he went into foundation work again. And just to sort of think about the trajectory, and I like the way that you use the term character arc, I said that right. And to see someone with what you would really call kind of civil rights credentials, really solid civil rights credentials, in the 1980s criticized by left labor
Absolutely.
Folks, right, for policies which place him in alliances with conservatives and religious groups, often the Catholic Church, and I think it was interesting today to see that Catholics were involved in all of these places. Probably progressive Catholics, sometimes without the support of bishops and people like that. But, okay, so now I know who this Howard Fuller is, because this whole history, I think, is something interesting. When we think about the legacies, and I think all the comments have been about legacies, one thing I think that's striking in Howard Fuller's case is that this early civil rights legacy was not often revealed in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And probably because his critics were on his side then, but they weren't on his side in the 1980s.
I think that's a fascinating point. Because it's interesting, because in Durham, especially amongst like the folks that were around back then, I mean, he's still hailed as like a god, basically. I mean, Ann Atwater basically compares him to Jesus Christ. And, you know, he's seen as completely, and just an interesting point, and this is how Dr. Fuller told me, George Bush asked him to be his Secretary of Education. Yes. was like, you should have. maybe there would have been something good. But he talked a lot about, because we actually had a lunch where we talked about the school choice issue, which I thought was so fascinating. And he was saying how just on that one issue, and people wouldn't even listen to what his ideas on that were, that he was just castigated for it, and just torn a new one, basically, because, and when he explained it to me, it actually made a whole lot of sense. But.
Well, and it was interesting, too, because the local politics, the grassroots politics of that were, I think, the real, I'm not trying to do this, were the really interesting thing, because African Americans in Milwaukee supported choice and charter. African American school teachers did not. And so it pitted the union against the community in many cases.
Wow.
And on the South Side, in the Latino community, the politics played out often the same way. And so you have poor people saying, wait a minute, we want choice and charter. And you had the middle class, a sort of middle class represented by the teachers union, the Democratic Party, and the unions sort of working almost against the community. And so the alliances were broken into pieces. And I think it's one thing to sort of think about how that gets restructured after the 80s and after people start to rethink, well, we have new bricks and mortar in our schools, but we don't have graduation rates
right. Have
changed at all over 50 years.
I want to do a whole documentary on Howard Fuller, personally. I mean, the man just fascinates me. Before I ever met him, I had just been hearing just all these folks. I mean, George Esser just could, he said, the greatest community organizer I've ever met is what he said. And then when I was sort of worried about meeting him because the expectation was so high, but he's such an unbelievably down-to-earth, brilliant, personable guy that I was just sitting there listening to him talk about, how to organize communities and, just this deep respect he has for people, all sorts of people. And one of the things that we filmed, and it was one of the original ends of the film, was him and Ann Atwater had not seen each other in, decades. And I brought him over to see her, and we filmed their reunion. And we interviewed them together, and all he kept saying was, Anne, you keep saying how much you learned from me, but really, it's all about what you and people like you did, and you're the ones that taught me. I mean, that's the kind of person he is, and it's just, to have that kind of exchange was just, it was amazing to be part of.
Yeah, which is why I want you to go back to that character arc and think about possibly, I don't know whether your funders feel that she has to be out.
They were not big Ann Atwater fans, which is... I was so mad. The original screening we had was a nightmare, actually, and I got a lot of really, I'll just say, I can't believe this is being recorded, but, but I did, and I was shocked because what the fund supposedly was all about was the people they were helping, and I was actually quite taken aback by their reaction to as much Anne as there was. And really, what we talked about in the end was, we did a lot about talking how the fund in and of itself was a successful endeavor, but then we sort of pulled out and talked about how stuff is crappy now, and used her as sort of the example because she's broke, she's still broke. Mm-hmm. She says, I'm always robbing Peter to pay Paul. That's what she says, and she looks out over her community, and finally you have these religious groups at Duke, like these divinity students who finally have taken her under their wing and are looking out for her now. But that's just within the last year. I mean, otherwise this woman has been struggling to pay bills, the whole deal. And we really did concentrate on that, and that was sort of this whole idea, because a good liberal person myself, and wanted to bring attention to the fact that in my area, particularly the poor sections of Durham, are a complete nightmare. And things have not changed, and in many ways they've gone back, or they're worse than they were. It was met with a lot of... It was actually surprising to me, the sort of animosity, I would even say, towards her. And she's like one of my heroes and a dear friend of mine. So I had to hold myself back and, pushed for it, but, in the end, unfortunately, we have editorial control, but, yeah.
but not really.
Right.
But just a question then, I mean, is there anyone else that you can use? I mean, there are a number of volunteers who you interview several times, and there are some of the key organizers who are interviewed numerous times. And I wonder if it has to be one of the legacies of the fund that they, you know, generate community organizers, you know, people who have those revelatory moments like she describes and go on to, you know, effective careers in politics. If not her, then someone else, or if not her, you know.
We were thinking about Ben Ruffin, because he came out, you know, he grew up in Durham and then worked in this area, and then he became the head of the Board of Governors. I mean, he was running the UNC system at one point. And I was like, well, no one could argue with that. But unfortunately, he's not as compelling as the others. He's sort of dry. I mean, he was a great man, don't get me wrong, but in terms of a character, like the sort of pull, I think it's Miss Atwater personally, but I'll go back and see if there's certain. But like I said, even if it doesn't get worked into the official film, it's going to be we have an Ann Atwater character arc like thing as a deleted scene, because my editor kept it intact, because this was something that we both were in total agreement on, and actually quite upset that it sort of got shifted.
I think Rhonda wants to jump on that, and then Tom's had his hand up.
Your read of where the animosity was coming from. What was the provoking element or elements of the animosity? What fed the animosity?
I'll tell you this. I think it was, on their part, I think it was a perception that it was making the fund look bad, that she was a failure. This is total theory on my part. But see, we had something in there where she talked about how George Esser offered her money to go to college. And she says, I turned it down because I felt that my community needed me to be there. She's not blaming anyone. She's just stating a fact. But for some reason, I think in their minds, I don't know. You know, honestly, I wish I did know. And it actually really upset me and made me think about some of those folks in a different way, which was very upsetting to me because, you know, I highly respected them, you know, in many, many cases. I mean, I still do to some degree, but I was sort of taken aback by it. So I don't really know where the animosity came from. It was particularly this one woman who unfortunately had at the time a lot of sort of control over George Esser because he was getting sick and she was, you know, manipulating it. I mean, you have no idea the kind of hell I went through with her. She literally sent me, first of all, she was so rude in her critique, and they sent us an email saying, you have to start from the beginning. The whole show needs to be scrapped. You know, that kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, so.
Tom.
I didn't expect to get into all this.
Tom and then Gordon.
Okay, I just gotta ask. I'm sorry. So what was happening in Western North Carolina? You seem to turn everything back to Durham again, and being the token Eastern Kentucky.
Western North Carolina was actually quite a success story in terms of what WAMI was able to do. They did unbelievable stuff with transportation. I mean, they actually got this rural transportation model set up. Also in places in Eastern North Carolina, they sort of did the same thing. Both of them were sort of got awards and stuff for sort of this rural transportation. And in fact, I mean, the mountains were very successful. You also had a person who was sort of running it, or who had brought it together, who was the head of the school up there, the college. So you had this buy-in from the university. And WAMI was actually put in to sort of, for several reasons, to sort of look at what happens in the South when race isn't an issue in this case. And also, it's a success story of the fund. It is an area where it was very successful. They really did get women out into the workforce. They really helped. The Neighborhood Youth Corps was extremely effective there. It really helped with the dropout rates and giving even kids that weren't going to drop out, giving them an opportunity to earn money so that they could go to college and various things like that. So it actually was quite successful. The problems they ran into were more, in terms of generational, I think, and in terms of people just not wanting to mess up the status quo, even if the status quo wasn't necessarily working for them. You know, so it was sort of that, and getting past the whole outsider, you know, the isolation and various things like that.
That's kind of an interesting point, because as you know, most of my volunteers are Eastern Kentucky, predominantly Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, and Kanawha and the Big Sandy Valley. And as I go through and I'm kind of picking up profiles of some of these guys, guys being gender generic, because it starts off as volunteers coming from Eastern Kentucky schools to go to Eastern Kentucky and fix everything up kind of thing. So it sounds very much, and I was struck by how many times I read, you know, the self-help thing. I thought that was just me. Like, everybody's got that. It was just floored me. But when I started going through and learning about who these guys were, now some of them are coming from very poor rural backgrounds, but they're getting into Berea College. And if you know anything about Berea College and all that kind of stuff, and they start buying the whole Berea College sort of mission thing, and they're making it, you know, to sort of a middle class kind of thing. And then when you read what these guys are telling, then the Vistas come in, and they're telling the Vistas, this is what you got to do, this is what you got to expect. And I'm noticing that the whole insider out thing is getting turned around. You know, it's not the Appalachian, poor Appalachian, isolated Appalachian out there that's saying outsiders are coming in. It's more these guys coming from Chicago and Haight-Ashbury, Milwaukee, you know, who are actually portraying the rural Appalachians as the outsiders. It's reversed. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that I'm picking up, and I was wondering if that's playing out anywhere else. And I hear there's discussions about, you know, Mexicans, Hispanics, and blacks working together and this kind of thing. And I'm thinking, I got kind of something playing out here amongst just rural whites about who's the insider, who's the outsider, because I think those guys coming from, you know, middle-class America, it's not the Appalachians that are playing the outsider card. It's the volunteers that are coming and playing the outsider card.
Well, True Elliott, who was the older lady from the mountains, she told me a story about a sort of northerner who came in to Whammy and was being paid this big consulting fee and all this stuff, and how he did not have a clue what was going on, and they really resented that, you know. So there was that perception on their end, but I also think that had a financial thing, which is another thing that I wish we could get into as well, which is that these grassroots, these, you know, folks like the Friendly Home Visitors, they were paid nothing, you know, as compared to the people in the administrative and the higher-ups in these poverty programs. You know, I mean, they were paid absolutely nothing. And so in a way, they were poverty-ridden themselves. And I thought that was really an interesting thing, because certainly, you know, people who were on the executive director and the deputy director and stuff, I'm sure that they were being paid a whole lot more. And so that was an issue with them in particular, saying, you know, why aren't we being paid a living wage? I mean, and they were saying, I mean, this was up, I mean, Betty worked for Whammy up until the 80s. And she said, I mean, they barely got, you know, a wage increase, like, you know, from the 60s. You know, and that was really, really difficult. But, you know, I think it depends on the person with the outsider-insider thing, you know. But I definitely think that as far as the people I was able to interview, that there was this idea of we don't want outsiders to come in. But then Betty and True were from the area, you know, and they didn't seem to have any problem, you know, going door to door and sort of talking with people. And I think that's the other thing. If you just talk to people like people, if you approach people as if they're humans, you know, that I think you can connect and reach out no matter where you're from, you know.
Thanks. But it made me think about something else that I've thought about with the North Carolina Fund and how it's been portrayed, both in Bob and Jim's book, you know, the manuscript, which I've read so far. And it's just Terry Sanford's portrayal. If there's any pressure to make him look out to be this grand hero, he sort of, you know, other than he being, I guess, the chair of the fund at the end, we don't really hear much about him. I don't know if there was any, you know, interest by funders or anyone else to make him out to be more progressive than he really was. and contrast it with, you know, this poor black woman who in a lot of ways is really the hero of the fund, you know, and it seems like there's almost, you know, there could be a creative tension there, which I think is interesting, but I don't know.
There wasn't really pressure with Terry Sanford, other than I felt, I mean, it was his idea. He approached the Ford Foundation, you know, whether or not he's portrayed as too progressive, you know, more progressive than he actually is or not, he still did, you know, make the move to do these pretty incredible, you know, things. I mean, he didn't have to deal with the issue of poverty. He didn't even have to think about it. He chose to. You know, whatever his motivations were, in the end, it did cost him politically, as I'm sure you know, in terms of governors at the time were only able to run for one term, but his successor that he picked to take over lost the election.
Right.
But the thing is, as far as I can see, he started it and then sort of let it run. And that's, I think, how we portray it, because I believe that sort of was the thing. He let George sort of take over, you know, and George Esser really was a really remarkable guy. I mean, just what he did with Howard Fuller, just, it's to this, you know, every time I see it, I'm sort of like, ow, you know. He not only did he not fire him, but he said, "No, in fact, I'm going to make you head of community organizing across the whole state," which, you know, it's pretty incredible stuff, considering. We had this great thing quote in there, Howard Fuller saying, "I really don't know how much trouble I got George into," you know, because he didn't. He was just doing his thing, but he said that George Esser never said no to him. He said, anything I brought up to him, anything I want to do, I just had to explain to him beforehand. He was all like, go for it. So, you know, but I felt, with the Terry Sanford thing, you know, it was sort of his idea. And, you know, with the movie, it's really hard to get into those nuances, you know, in terms of, you know, any, you know, other stuff.
I think I would say that the biography of Sanford is too soft on him, but that the film isn't, only because the film doesn't really get into the places where Sanford's politics maybe broke down a little.
Right, which they did, of course.
Which they did,
right.
Too generously, well, in my opinion, although if I have to pick a white Southern governor of the time.
Right. In comparison
to the others, he's pretty palatable.
Well, just the fact that he sent his kids to integrated schools, I mean, just, yeah. You know. It's pretty incredible.
Guillen and then Tom.
The Howard Fuller role. And one thing I've struggled with a bit in grassroots work is the role of leadership and strong leader figures like Fuller, and particularly in relation to gender issues. And this is as much a question for all of you as for Rebecca, you can explain too. Is, you know, how does leadership play in groups like this? How does it matter? How do we write about leaders, strong, particularly, I guess, male leaders in this and some other cases, although not necessarily, I don't want to limit it to that, in terms of the other things that we're really trying to examine in the kind of work we're doing?
Well, just to quickly answer that, another great thing he said in his interview was what he felt the difference between being a facilitator and a leader was, and how he was saying that within the leadership, really he wanted to create a space that when he stepped off the stage, which he knew he would at some point, that he would leave people that were able to do it, which is not what all leaders think about. You know, a lot of times when you get power, you get, you know, get sort of corrupted by it and, you know, want to grab on to it. And he never thought of it that way. He was always like, you know, I was just trying to get, you know, people to realize their potential, realize their power. And, you know, he ran these things, community action technician training, where, you know, they train people to become organizers, to become facilitators, to sort of take over. He organized these neighborhood councils. So he was really about, you know, promoting local leadership and making sure that when he did step away, that you had people like Ann Atwater and you had these other folks that would continue. And for a very long time in Durham, that was the case. In terms of male or whatever, to me, I think it's about charisma, you know, more than male or female. I mean, and he just happens to have the charisma, you know, that people want to follow him. People want to do stuff. Also, he knew how to get to people. Don't promise someone something that you can't deliver on. And that's what he instilled in the people that he trained. And also, if there's something you don't know, tell the person the truth, go find it, and bring it back to them. You know, it was this very personal interaction was essential, you know, and building the trust and building up the people themselves. And I don't think that it's a male-female thing. I think it's a good leader versus a not good leader, you know. And he just happened to be, you know, someone that had a lot of great ideas about leadership in my mind. But I think it's essential to leave people, to train people that can take over, because, you know, there's no guarantees that Howard Fuller was going to stay, which he sort of knew he wouldn't.
Different arenas of politics, I think what, and this actually supports Rhonda's point, that winning representation on anti-poverty boards was itself a form of learning and empowerment. I'm wondering if there are opportunities that you considered to give us a sense of the fluidity of the issues that local activists were working on. I mean, I do have a nice sense of that, from the family planning stuff in the West to picketing the Republican senator's house. But it struck me that there's an opportunity up at, what's the place, CADA. And I was curious about what they were doing on the ground. And if there are more issues, because one thing that we can appreciate is just poverty touches on every
yes.
conceivable issue, and the fluidity of activists moving from one issue to another is, to me, a really fascinating
I agree. Originally, the way we envisioned the film and the way we interviewed for it was going to be those three locations. It was going to be the mountains, it was going to be Durham, and it was going to be northeastern North Carolina. Because the thing that's interesting about northeastern North Carolina, and actually it sort of mirrored what went on in Durham, which of course we didn't get into because of the acronym issue, which is all these different organizations to confuse people, was that you had this Chowanoke Area Development Association, which was really about middle-class people. It wasn't about poor people. It wasn't really about involving poor people in the decision-making process. And I think that's what Selma Majette starts talking about. And CADA says they're this anti-poverty organization, but none of the money was getting to people that were really in poverty and things like this. So then you had these, and in fact, as we were talking about earlier, you had a long tradition of activism in this area amongst the African American community in terms of voting drives and things like this. So they and also the church. Reverend Felton was sort of the head of this very activist black church, and he actually some of the footage there he filmed on 16mm. And he took a broken down car full of people from northeastern North Carolina up to D.C. to testify in front of Congress about poverty. So they, you know, they tried to talk with CADA about real representation and things like this, and then it just wasn't going to happen. That's when they had the People's Conference on Poverty. And they decided after that to start their own organization, which was called PPOP, People's Program on Poverty. And at the same time, in Durham, you had all these sort of political things going wrong in terms of they were bringing people to the polls with Operation Breakthrough Vehicles, which they got another reprimand from, you know, and sort of. So then this idea came in Durham too, which was to sort of break free and start another organization, very much like PPOP, which was built, controlled, created by the poor people themselves, to be able to sort of do different things like this. In northeastern North Carolina, CADA and PPOP become adversaries and butt heads and actually are fighting not just the fund, but also OEO for funds. PPOP got OEO to stop funding CADA for a little bit because they were able to show that maximum feasible participation was not going on. In Durham, however, the organization started and run by poor folks worked absolutely in conjunction with Operation Breakthrough and did the things that, quote, Operation Breakthrough could no longer do because of Hatch Act and various things, because they were funded particularly by OEO, and now UOCI was being funded by the foundation money that the fund still had, so they had more. But they ended up working together, you know, on that. So this, there, it's just.
Well, I see how the Northeastern story would be hard to capture filmically, but just in terms of praxis to show.
But yeah, I mean, across the board, they were doing stuff. In every housing, jobs, education. I mean, there's a whole education component to this that the Ford Foundation ended up giving this $2.3 million grant to the North Carolina Board of Education, who ended up, not using it because they didn't really want to do anything. And in fact, Ford took the money back from them, and this was towards the end, and gave it to the fund. And this is how one of the big chunks of money that the fund used to start these development corporations that ended up taking off from where, you know, UOCI and PPOP were going. And you had organizations run by poor folks specifically dealing with these issues. And what happens then is it's split up, so like the Foundation for Community Development, like one is just dealing with housing, one is just dealing with education. So it becomes more specialized in terms of scope like that.
Kent?
I have a question.
Oh, good.
I'm really taken by the music that you use in this, and I'm just curious what it is and, you know, how you layer it in.
Taken in a good way, I hope?
No, I really like it.
Oh,
no, yeah.
Great. I do, too. My editor's brother-in-law is a local musician, and Tom is my editor. I trust him. He worked with me on my first film, which was February 1, The Story of the Greensboro Four, about the civil rights incidents that happened in 1960, and I'm proud to say we actually got a national PBS broadcast for that. So when Tom said, well, you know, my brother-in-law, he's a musician in this local band, can we maybe give him a shot? And I was like, absolutely. And so we had these discussions, and he ended up being literally right on board. And everything that we had sort of described to him, he comes back with, and it was like, wow. You know, and to me, it just adds so much, like tension and various other things, especially when the audio mix is better and the narration and some of the interview clip bites, you know, the audio is better. I think it really is. So I'm so pleased that you like it.
So you're bringing a North Carolina musician out of poverty by exposing their
music. Yes. Yeah. Well, he never scored for a film before, but had seen February 1 and loved it so much and wanted a chance to, you know, take part in it. And then when I saw what he came up with, I was like, you know, I said, man, I would buy it, you know, just to listen to as a score. Yeah.
Tom.
This is just sort of, a factual fill-in a background question. Henry Saltzman, what was did he have a specific connection to the North Carolina Fund?
Yep.
And what was that? And the reason I ask is because he's in Eastern Kentucky as early as 1959, working with the Council of Southern Mountains, which was a private kind of charity organization, coming out of Berea College again. So he's got connections running through that, you know, Southern Appalachian Mountains. Apparently, I didn't know what his connection specifically was with North Carolina, so if you could just tell me what that is.
Yeah, he was working for the Ford Foundation, and he was one of the field agents that was sent to sort of check out the area. Obviously, before Ford, you know, gave any money, they sent many, you know, field agents to sort of go to the governor's mansion, and then they took him around the entire state, and he was one of them. Also, he forged a very deep friendship with George Esser. So they actually kept in touch, and that's sort of how he has deep esteem for George Esser, and that's sort of how I got back in touch with him, and he's still doing this work. You know, he's still involved in public education and doing great stuff like that. But yeah, he just came as a field worker, and I think was so taken in by George Esser, you know, he sort of became infatuated, not in a sexual way, obviously, but, you know, with his ideas, and was always someone that he really looked up to. I mean, he hadn't seen George in forever, and when George passed away, Billy Barnes called him, and he said that he was just devastated, you know, over it. And just in the interview, just on and on, heaping on the praise about, you know, sort of this vision and what George was able to do in such a short time. That's sort of the other thing that blows me away is most corporations, you know, take a year or two to just get going. You know, here they came up with this idea and they were ready to go in a couple months, you know, and were able to, you know, and even just this and even the 11 sites and all this is only a fraction of what they actually did. And it's, I'm like, we need people like that now. We need doers now.
Cities have poverty because it's poor rural Southerners, you know, blacks and Appalachians that are moving to these cities, bringing poverty with them. So these urban workshops are supposed to, yeah, it's kind of cool. Most of these urban workshops are supposed to deal with, you know, because it has this cultural bent to it. You know, they're bringing, you know, rural, you know, ways and means to modern places and don't fit in and all this kind of stuff. So Salton was on the ground floor working on these kind of issues in Berea, very quickly. I mean, they came down and, you're right. He moved very fast and very effectively.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Farmers Matter. There should be food of some sort out in the lobby, kind of a reception and stuff. So feel free to help yourself. We can just keep talking. The bus to the restaurant is already 7-ish, I think, roughly. Yeah. So that's just our time.
Okay. Yeah, I did want to acknowledge that at this point we're 10 minutes past our finish up time, but which is great. So the reception and a dinner? So you're going to fill up on reception food and then go eat? Yeah, pretty much. So if you want to, yeah, go ahead.
I just had a few follow-up comments, and we can discuss them later, but just to get them out there. One thing that follows up on Guillen's question about leadership and the question of gender, male and female, and even your response around charisma, I will push us to think more about this question of leadership and gender and how that's defined, even around the question of charisma. Because usually when we talk about charisma, either in the history or in the public perception, it's usually male defined. For instance, when we say charisma, we don't think of Ella Baker and her whole belief system in participatory democracy, which is how you were describing what Howard Fuller does and what his stance is. Or we don't even think of Ann Atwater as charisma, or Ruby Duncan as having charisma, or Shirley Wise in my community as having charisma. So, and what that means in terms of being leaders in communities and who are kind of the defined leaders in communities. So I think we need to be pushed on that, and I don't know in what way the film, if anything, could be pushed on thinking about that. I think it really goes back to a lot of the issues of, can we bring Ann back in? Can we think about how to weave that narrative in? But, of course, there are some issues, which leads me to my other two points that I wanted to ask you about, and these are professional questions. And one is, I'm curious about the ways in which you prepared yourself intellectually and in the creative process of doing this film. In other words, what kinds of things did you lay your hands on or go to begin to think about the nitty-gritty issues and hardcore issues, not just around Durham, but around these larger kind of questions that are emerging here? And secondly, how did you navigate, because I'm listening to you and answering the questions, and I'm seeing the film, and I'm saying to myself, if I were a person at home looking at the film, I would have a totally different perception of what I'm now getting in this room, having had things discussed and more fully fleshed out. So I'm wondering how you yourself navigated the politicization of your own production of the film, which seems to me to be laying on the more kind of wholly positive side of the fun versus the kind of much more critical, complex depiction that you have discussed with us here in the room. And if there's any possibility, therefore, of maybe having not only the cut, deleted scenes, but a companion pamphlet or teaching guide or something
absolutely.
Like that.
Oh, that's would, absolutely yeah. going to happen, as well as the website. And Yeah, unfortunately, like I said, with films, it's extremely hard to sort of get at all of these issues, because every single new thing you introduce needs some sort of context, it needs some sort of setup, and you know, there are certain things that you know you just don't want to just spend a minute on. You know, you want to be able to flesh it out, and if that's the case, then you know what else has to come out, and all this other. I mean, it's an extremely difficult. Especially with this film, it was very, very hard. It wasn't as hard with the Greensboro film, although taking stuff out of there was painful as well. In terms of preparation for this, they have an amazing collection of all the North Carolina Fund papers at UNC Chapel Hill. I think these folks kept every piece of paper they ever wrote, literally, and it's very well organized. Plus, they have the films that they commissioned, and almost all the photos that you saw in there were taken by Billy Barnes, who was the Officer of Public Information, and he donated his photos to us for the film. So basically, I just immersed myself in the archives, you know, and sort of just tried to, like with the volunteer stuff, the amazing stuff, all the volunteers kept handwritten logs. They're all in there. So in fact, Alan Fairbank, I copied his logs for him, and I gave them to him when I interviewed him, and he hadn't read them in like 40 years, you know, and he was like, you know, blown away by young Alan Fairbank, you know, as opposed to sort of now. So I tried to do that, you know, really, that's what I do. I just immerse myself in the research and, you know, to try and get a feel for just, you know, on paper what is going on, so that when I do interview people out in the field, I can actually ask intelligent questions and various things like that. The other thing is, I just, you know, I love hearing people's stories, and so I engage people to just talk about stuff, and so I learned a lot just from the people I interviewed. I mean, the women aspect. I mean, honestly, I hate to say, but when we first conceptualized, there wasn't going to be a whole separate section on, you know, sort of the controversy of women being involved in all this, but in the Planned Parenthood, any of that. But when I interviewed folks and I just saw this reoccurring thing kept coming up, I was like, well, this has to be in there. You know, we have to definitely, you know, touch on this. So in terms of the second more complex question, which you can see I'm avoiding.
Well, we can talk about
that. Okay.
I think that's a great ending point. Thank you so much.